Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. There is still a lot of water stored in the Sierra snowpack. The latest manual snow survey on Monday, which was held at Phillips Station just outside Sierra at Tahoe Ski Resort along Highway 50 in El Dorado County, shows that there is more than twice the amount of snow than average for this time of year. They say the last time there was measurable snow on May 1st was back in 2020 with just an inch and a half of snow. But this year alone, there was 59 inches still at this specific location, and 30 inches of that snowpack is all water. California's Department of Water Resources, DWR, conducts this monthly manual snow survey during the winter months, but there are more than 100 electronic snow sensors across the Sierra Nevada. The big headline is, we still have a long way to go before all of that snow melts into our rivers and reservoirs. Joining us to talk about the latest readings from DWR is Jeffrey Mount, Senior Fellow at the Public Policy Institute of California, PPIC, and he is an expert in water and climate change policy. Jeffrey, good morning.
Good morning, Vicky.
So May snow surveys don't always happen. How unusual is it for DWR to do a reading for May?
Well, actually, we do a reading every year in May. The only thing is the last few years, we completely forgot about it because it was pretty much bare ground.
Right.
And so, it might have made a good thing for the press to go up and get a picture of them trying to stick a pipe into grass. But I mean, when you think of where we were last year at this time, or worse yet, 2 years ago at this time, there was just basically no snow on the ground. And now we are really wearing out the word epic, but it's a pretty epic spring snowpack.
Yeah, I mean, the numbers show the Sierra snowpack across the state on average is 254% for this time of year. It obviously varies because it gets broken down between the southern, the central, and the Sierra and the northern Sierra. So can you put all of this into historical terms?
Yeah, so I remember there was a breathless article in the Mercury News about, you know, debunking the notion that this was a record year. And the problem is they tended to just lump the whole state. So it's not a record statewide, but there are areas where it has been a record snowpack. And that's the Southern Sierra, which drains into the Tulare Basin. That is still extraordinary. The percent of normal for this date, normal meaning average, I mean, it's now at 340% of average for this date. It's almost 2.5 times what it would be on April 1st. And I give you a perspective on this, Vicky. The amount of water that's up there in snow is equal to 2.5 times the amount of water that runs off in an entire year in that basin. So that's why, you know, we get, no, that was a lot of snow. As we move north and get up into our area, the epicness, if that's a word, declines because we had a very wet year in the American River Basin, but not unprecedented. Didn't rise to the level of epic. So that's what you see is a gradient of extreme snowpack in the Southern Sierra getting less and less as you go to the north.
Mm. Let's start with some good news. What is the best case scenario for all of this snowmelt?
Oh, there's a mess of good news in all that snow. First of all, obviously we're going to start by the way, mostly reservoir operators are trying to fill their reservoirs and get them up to full and ready to go for the height of the irrigation season, which is where most of the water goes and the height of demands. And they're actually emptying their reservoirs in some places, trying to make room for this. That is a nice problem to have. We're also going to see, because of this sustained runoff, this is probably going to be one of our biggest groundwater recharge years, because basically, I mean, what you'd like all the farmers to do is over irrigate this year if they could, because that over irrigated water is going to go basically into groundwater. And we're going to stop fighting about too little water for at least the short term. And now we're fighting about too much water, at least in some places.
Yeah, the temperatures have kind of been swinging a little bit. I mean, we were touching or flirting with 90s or in the 90s in some areas. This week is cooler. DWR says the snow is melting slower than average, only about like 12 inches melted in the last month. What does this signal to you?
Okay, well, there's a couple of things, and your listeners might want to know what's going on in the snowpack right now. So about a month ago, the snowpack really started to warm up, and it's a fancy term they call isothermal, which just means the temperature's the same throughout the snowpack. Usually it's warmer at the top and colder at the bottom, but once it gets all the same temperature and about 32 degrees, that's when it is ripe and it starts running off. And once that starts, there's no stopping that. But we had a spell of cool. Well, we're in it. I mean, I'm looking out my window right now and I'm wearing a puffy jacket. It's May. How dare you? So this cool weather has basically slowed the rate of melt, but it certainly isn't going to stop the melt. So we're still seeing our rivers running high in all of this. And what it does is it puts off that snow melt for a couple of weeks. Vicky, just last week, in that heat wave, the models were predicting we'd hit peak snowmelt runoff in the next week or so on the American River in the next couple of weeks in the Southern Sierras. And now they're putting it all off to the end of the month. And of course, in the high elevation watersheds like the San Joaquin until really early June sometime is the peak runoff.
Yeah. I mean, there is, you know, good news with all of this, but there's also still concerns and risks. You mentioned that the Southern Sierra has record snowpack, and you've joined us before about the Tulare Basin. You know, does this new report, this new survey and update from DWR improve, or does it worsen the prognosis for spring and summer flooding in that area?
That's a really good question, and it's regrettably a nuanced answer. Right off the bat, this is good news for the San Joaquin River in the sense that they have been aggressively emptying their reservoirs to the maximum amount that the downstream channels can handle. So they've got more capacity to manage this inflow. They're even doing it upstream as well. So on the San Joaquin side, this cool weather gave them a bit of a breather. But it's not going to change anything just to the south of that in the Tulare Basin. That water is there. It's got to go somewhere. And that they've got, other than the amount of water they push over into the San Joaquin, it's going to go into a bowl and fill up a bowl. It's not going to go anywhere but into that bowl. So they're just kind of putting off the inevitable down there. But that said, it still gives them time on the ground to reinforce levees, to try to channelize the water where they can and kind of manage it, because the water's only rising like a couple inches a day. And so that gives them time. So, yeah, so it's a mixed bag. And by the way, all of this discussion changes if we go back into a heat wave next week. And that's the scary part.
Yeah. I mean, there are still a lot of unknowns, right? And so when I think about our area, and this is my final question, I think about, you know, our local major rivers. You have the Sacramento and American rivers, but you also have the Cosumnes, the McCollumee, Feather. What stands out to you about how the runoff is going to impact our local waterways?
So we're in good shape on a flood control side. We're going to have a great guy. It is my suggestion to every one of your readers to go on a raft trip this spring, because it's going to be exciting, cold and fun. And it's just going to be great. And that's going to last well into the summer. But all our rivers are running relatively high for this time of year. The Cosumnes has already peaked. It's probably on its way down starting next week. The American River inflow to Folsom will probably peak in the next couple of weeks and then start its long, slow decline. Feather River is already probably peaked. So I mean, we're up here in the north. We're kind of past the excitement in this case. To the south, the excitement is yet to come.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Jeffrey. If my husband is listening, he really likes the water rafting part of your conversation.
Me too.
Jeffrey Mound is a senior fellow at the Public Policy Institute of California, PPIC, and an expert in water and climate change policy. Up next, we're going to have a discussion about the mother-daughter relationship in Asian American families and the significance of the Oscar-winning film Everything, Everywhere, All at Once. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. We're taking a quick break. We'll be with you in just a few minutes.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. For the past 6 weeks, we have been diving into Cap Radio's newest podcast, Mid-Pacific, which explores the hard-to-define Asian American identity. Through food, politics, mental health, music, and so much more, we learn how loaded of a question it can be. Well, the final episode just dropped this morning, and the focus is on family. Whether Asian American, or you have a story of immigration, or you're just a 10th generation Californian, regardless, the family that comes before us shapes how we walk through life. And in recent years, the dynamic of Asian American families is taking more of the spotlight in pop culture. The biggest example is the Oscar-winning film Everything, Everywhere, All at Once, which hones in on the mother-daughter relationship, among other themes. And this film deeply resonates with some of the journalists you listen to every day on Cap Radio. We're joined by race and equity reporter and host of the podcast Mid-Pacific, Sarah Mises-Tan, as well as Cap Radio reporters Janelle Salonga and Kristen Lamb. Good morning to you all.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay. Good morning. Well, Sarah, I want to start with you because this is the final episode drop of Mid-Pacific. And as a journalist, you really took this personal shift with this series. You were exploring Asian American identity, but listeners also got to learn a great deal from many voices, you included. And you really show that by interviewing your mom and your sister. So how did all of this come about?
Oh, my gosh. Well, the mother-daughter relationship has definitely been a topic that I've wanted to dive into for a long time. I feel like it's so complex, especially kind of with Asian American identity layered on top and this like acculturation gap that kind of happens when you've got a difference in immigration pattern and experiences in this country. And, you know, I think my relationship with my mother and my sister's relationship with my mother has always been kind of this like own narrative of its own, honestly. And so when I wanted to talk about the mother-daughter relationship, I initially actually was not going to include them because it seemed a little too close. But it was a story editor that we had who was like, well, why don't you just ask your mom what she thinks? And I was like, oh my God. But also, I hope people enjoy us getting real, real and a little bit raw, I guess.
Yeah. And I think it resonates with a lot of people. So the springboard for the conversation that we're going to be having right now is the film Everything, Everywhere, All at Once. For those who haven't seen the movie, why is this a really profound symbol of Asian American identity and culture?
Yeah, you know, I guess I think of Everything Everywhere All at Once as being like particular in itself, just because it really gets messy when it comes to Asian American identity. I think as we're going to get into, there are a lot of lines that just like hit in a particular way if you are Asian American. And it just goes there with the mother-daughter relationship. It doesn't hold back. To me, it felt like a very real depiction of a lot of the conversations I've had with my own mother. And then I think like just the fact that it showcases different generations. I think that intergenerational conversations and intergenerational relationships are very much a part of the Asian American experience as well. And I think it just did that in a really nuanced way where it wasn't like stereotypical. And I loved that. And I think that's probably what resonated with a lot of people with this movie.
Yeah, I mean, it was very much real. But then there's also these kind of ridiculous parts as well. You're like, you know, because and I don't want to give it away, but it's definitely worth watching. So, Janelle, that brings me to you. How did this film resonate with you and your family?
Yeah, I mean, everything Sarah said is so true, I guess, for me as well, especially like watching those intergenerational relationships and this kind of like very fraught relationship with a mother and her daughter that kind of just stems from, you know, like different understandings of the world and of each other and different expectations along those lines. And I think that's something that, you know, is very resonant for me. But from, I guess, like a more lighthearted angle, as you were saying, like there are these moments like, you know, characters will say the name of, for example, like a movie, just a hair off what the actual movie title is. And that to me feels like such a relevant experience, you know, especially like having parents who immigrated, who, you know, sometimes don't always have the right words in English, like right off the bat. Like that was very resonant for me. And then also there's like a line about, you know, the mom talks about how, you know, I hate that you get tattoos. You know that I hate that you get tattoos. I don't care if you say that it's for your family. I have like over 20 tattoos. And this is, you know, a conversation that I've continually had with my parents. So those are a couple of ways that, you know, for me, the movie, even in its lighthearted moments, made me feel really seen.
Mm. How about you, Kristen? Because you actually watched it with your mom, right?
Yeah, I mean, my mom also loved the movie, and particularly, like, one of her favorite things is just having a middle-aged Asian woman be the star and have so much range. And I think in general, like has been said, like, I just see a lot of my family and myself in the film. Like, particularly, even though I'm like fourth and second generation Asian American on with my family, like, I still see, like, my grandparents on my dad's side immigrated from Hong Kong, speak Cantonese. Like, the grandpa in the movie really reminds me of my late grandfather. And it's pretty wild.
So, Kristen, what were some of the hardest or some of the more emotional parts during the movie for you?
I think the ending sequence always gets me. Like, the first few times I would watch it, I would always be like sobbing the last like 10 minutes. But I think like the confrontations, especially between like Evelyn and her father and then Evelyn and Joy, are always really hard to watch.
How about you, Janelle?
Yeah, honestly, it's the same. I mean, I love the like just seeing the switch that flips with, you know, Evelyn talking about like her daughter's kind of like nihilism and depression and detachment as something separate from her to accepting like that is something that is part of her. I think especially as somebody who, you know, has mental illness, who struggles with their own things, like it's like really meaningful, I guess, to see that depiction of someone coming to terms with, you know, from the other side, that that's not like those, like the mental illness or, you know, whatnot is inextricable from how like that person experiences the world. It's not something that, you know, can kind of just be divorced from somebody's personhood. And then, you know, at the end, the confrontation where Evelyn says, "I am your mother. Don't call me Evelyn." That's so like, you know, I'm in my 20s and that's still something, you know, I've joked around like, oh, calling my parents by their first names, but it feels so wrong. Like the "I am your mother" part is so funny. But it's also so emotional because that's like, I think, such a signifier of family relationships. And the speech that Kristen is talking about between Evelyn and her father, or Joy's grandpa, you know, is also has me bawling, you know, because that's also a signifier of Joy coming, or Evelyn coming to terms with the fact that her daughter is not this like perfect person, that she is a person who has, you know, dreams and goals and feelings all on her own. And no matter how much like she as a mom wants to control that, you know, she can't. And that is really emotional for me every time.
Yeah, regardless of her family, we're still constantly learning about each other. And a big piece of that is acceptance, right? And accepting our family members. How about you, Sarah?
Oh, totally. I think I'm going to jump on and agree with Kristen and Danielle that last scene where Evelyn confronts her daughter. Oh my God. I like cry every time I watch it. It's like actually visually difficult for me to get through it without having to turn away. I was like looking too close to the sink, getting too close to the sun, honestly.
Watching with your like finger, with your hands in front of your face.
Totally. I mean, I'm tearing up just like talking about it a little bit, just because it's like, you know, for me, I felt like it was like this moment that was, I guess maybe like many Asian American daughters, I have a somewhat difficult relationship with my mother, and my career choice is not something that she saw for me. And so I really resonated a lot with Joy as just like being this example, almost like a villain to my mom's life, which I think is something that really resonated with me. Like my mom, I think, sometimes looks at me and is like, "You are the literal foil. Like you are just here to torture me." And so it's like a really, I guess it's a moment of relief when Evelyn and Joy have that confrontation, and Evelyn actually like, she says she's sorry, and that's something that I think a lot of maybe immigrant mothers have a difficult time with sometimes. And I guess that's like, I don't know, I guess they just say things that I wish my own mother could kind of like be able to step back and see in herself and maybe say she's sorry. I guess I wish that we had that moment ourselves, and we don't, because this is real life and not like a superhero movie.
Yeah, what I've learned just being mixed race, and it's not only with my Asian American background, but, you know, oftentimes like people, in my family show they're sorry. They don't actually say totally. They're sorry,
so,
right?
Yeah, absolutely.
That word is a tricky one. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Cap Radio reporters Sarah Mises-Tan, Janelle Salonga, and Kristen Lam about how the movie Everything, Everywhere, All at Once resonated with their Asian American identities. So this movie touches upon a lot of themes. I mean, the daughter, Joy, is an only child. But for what I'm going to ask you next, this would also be considered like the eldest, right, of the family. How did this resonate with each of you, Sarah?
Well, I am, I guess, the eldest, eldest daughter. And so there are a lot of expectations, I think. And this is something we touch on in the podcast as well. But for some reason, I think eldest child, especially for a family that has immigrated to this country, I think there's a lot of expectations on what that child's going to be and what their career is going to be and who they're going to, you know, all this kind of stuff. And so I feel like all of that layered on top of, I think, just general expectations that mothers have for their daughters. Because oftentimes I think mothers see daughters as an extension of themselves, and it gets really intense for Asian Americans in particular. You know, I think when it comes to, I guess I like don't want to stereotype or like speak too much for other people. So I'll let Janelle and Kristen jump in a second. But, you know, when it comes to like the very particular kind of back and forth poll that we discuss about being a first daughter and being Asian American, I think it's basically like the most, it's a very intense push and pull of like you trying to define your own identity versus someone else kind of putting expectations on you and you feeling pressure to fulfill those expectations.
Yeah. Conditions, right? Yeah. How about you, Janelle?
Yeah, and I think, too, I'm also the eldest, but it's kind of an unusual dynamic in that my sister is, you know, almost 12 years younger than me. So in a sense, I spent most of my early part of my life as an only child. And I do think that, you know, that experience was very starkly different, you know, from my teenage years for a lot of different reasons. And I think, you know, the fact that my mom had me when she was, you know, comparatively young, you know, she was still in her 20s, whereas, you know, my sister was born when my mom had lived a little more life, right? Like, I think that that is like another layer of the dynamic of, you know, just it's essentially, you know, my mom is growing up kind of at the same time as I am. And I think that that makes for a lot of misunderstandings and a lot of expectations in different directions, especially with kind of like, you know, the cultural background of different expectations. You know, my mom is from the Philippines. I was born in America. And I think that there are some, I guess, like there's some chafing there between what's expected and what's maybe I'm just kind of like sounding like a broken record repeating what Sarah said. But yeah, I think there's this concept that is often referenced that I feel a little bit loath to reference because I think it's a little more complicated than people usually depict it. But it's called utang na loob. And it's kind of this idea that you're, you know, in debt to your family. But you know, with a little bit more weight to that, not in the sense of like, oh, this is a terrible burden I must bear, but like the burden of gratitude almost. And so, you know, navigating that, I think, especially as somebody who has complicated feelings about being American is definitely, you know, something else to be added onto the pile of, you know, what makes like being the eldest, specifically in an Asian American family, like very fraught, I guess.
Yeah, there's another layer to this because the daughter in the film is openly gay. So how do you feel this dynamic? How do you feel it was portrayed in the film? Kristen, I'll start with you.
Yeah, I mean, I am a gay woman, and I have also had times in my family where kind of processing that has been difficult. Like some of the lines where Evelyn says that she thinks that the grandfather would have a heart attack, wouldn't be able to handle, like knowing that his granddaughter is gay, or even when she tells Joy, you know, he's from a different generation. Like those are all exact things my mom has told to me about her own mother. And I feel like it felt really real. Yeah, it can just be like I see like how I can see like my mom's like how she has kind of grown and our relationship has also changed. I mean, you know, the grandfather's still alive in the movie, but in my case, like some of the issues that I had with grandparents, with like, you know, this is just my partner, it's just my friend. You know, now those, some of those grandparents are no longer with us. So I felt it was very real and very personal.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. Janelle, what did you think about, you know, the choice that they made by including this dynamic in the film?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's so, I'm so glad that they included it because I think that, you know, especially seeing, I don't know that Joy, you know, necessarily comes out and says, like, I'm a lesbian necessarily, but I think that, like, having, you know, specifically, like, gay women in like movies or TV shows isn't necessarily something that is still super common. And I feel like that is huge. And especially to do that, you know, from the lens of the Asian American experience is also pretty impactful because, you know, just as like being a person is impacted by, you know, your cultural background, like obviously how you experience, you know, dating and sexuality is also influenced by that cultural background. And I think like, you know, I've also had a lot of friends who have dealt with those kind of same dynamics with their parents and that kind of tension of, like Kristen mentioned, that idea of like, oh, your partner is just your friend. And it, I think it was really meaningful to see all of that like represented like at large in a way that like, you know, didn't really diminish like Joy's sexuality or didn't say like, oh, this is just some random thing. And I really appreciated that there was, like, you know, nuance to that.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, you know, like, when you watch the trailer, you are obviously, like, all in on watching the movie. Did it meet your expectations? Sarah?
Oh, my gosh. Yes. I think, I mean, you know, I love that it's kind of like a superhero, like a weird, fantastical superhero battle for so much of it. And then it just like hits you right in the emotional gut at the end. I think I wasn't really expecting that. I was expecting it to kind of be more lighthearted and funny. And it is. But yeah, I think it delivered personally.
How about you, Janelle?
Yeah. I mean, I had no idea what to expect going into it. The reason that I watched it or wanted to watch it was actually because of this Twitter thread that my friend made, you know, speaking about how the movie raised questions of what would it be like, you know, if we let go of our debts to each other, if we let kind of the like misunderstandings just be and make an effort to better accept and understand each other where they are. And so that was my understanding of the movie going into it. I didn't expect to, you know, have so much fun watching it, but I also did not expect to like bawl my eyes out. It was kind of gross. Like I was in the theater and like there's tears collecting behind my mask and I was like, this is terrible. But in that way, it totally met expectation, or like I guess like exceeded expectations, and I really loved it. I've watched it way too many times than probably I should, but yeah, I loved it. I love that it was like, I think, a really good piece of science fiction. You know, speaking about like the apology, this like fantastical apology, it's science fiction in the sense of like it's improbable, but it's not necessarily impossible. It's something that we can imagine in our own lives. And I thought that was really magical to be a part of.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, it dives into like really like heavy dynamics, but it's also so much fun, right? You know, they have a lot of fun with it. Kristen, what was your favorite part in the film?
I really like the rock scene. Yeah, there are just some parts where it's just like so wild and you're like, oh my gosh. And I also like the parts that make my mom uncomfortable, like some thing scenes with trophies that they sit on. those are good.
Oh my god, I love that there's like a scene where they're like, the two, Evelyn and Joy, are fighting, and at some point Evelyn's just like, Joy, why are you wearing such a stupid outfit? And I was like, oh my god, it's like exactly something my mom would say in the middle of like an actual like serious discussion, just something like totally irrelevant, like, oh, we're gonna worry about what I'm wearing right now. Okay.
Like, are you listening to me? Yeah. How about you, Janelle?
I know we've been talking about mother-daughter relationships, but I really love the dad. I think my, you know, typically Asian dads are presented as stoic, but my dad has always been really silly and funny, and I think Waymond really got to the heart of that, and I really loved, you know, his philosophy about, you know, choosing to see the good side of things. I think that was really powerful, and I cried at that too, but I cried at a lot of the movie, so.
Well, I want to thank all three of you. What a fun conversation.
Thanks so much, Vicky.
Yeah, thanks.
I guess what really quickly, Sarah, since, you know, this is the final drop of the podcast, how are you feeling?
Oh my gosh. I'm feeling excited that our last episode is up because I do personally feel like that one is the most meaningful to me. I do hope that people will take a listen to it and really try to get into it a little bit. And I'm kind of sad that it's wrapping too. There are lots of topics that we did not get to touch on just given the time frame of what we had to work with. So hopefully season two, right?
Yeah. Putting a bow on it just for season one, right? There'll be totally. A season two. That is Cap Radio reporters Sarah Mises-Tan, Janelle Salonga, and Kristen Lam sharing how the movie Everything, Everywhere, All at Once resonated with their own Asian American identities. This conversation is part of Cap Radio's podcast Mid-Pacific. The final episode dropped this morning. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. It is that time to hear some of the best live music that we'll be performing in Sacramento on Concert Connects. This edition features local artists building major buzz for a music-hungry audience. Here to share the hidden gems that are excavators of music are Cap Radio's Nick Bruner and Andrew Garcia. Thanks for joining us.
Every time she does that, I'm just always like, that's just so descriptive. Do we deserve that, Andrew?
It's the reason I keep coming back every time. Is that okay? It's so exciting to,
right,
to
excellent.
Hear.
Well, thank you,
Vicky.
I'm
happy to stroke the ego. That's fine. That's what I'm here for. So, okay, Nick, I'm going to start with you this time.
Okay.
The first show is a great showcase of the Sacramento music scene with the album release of Lab Rats. And there's some supporting acts that are familiar names to Cap Radio.
Coco Lilani is an absolute gem of a Sacramento musician. I found out about her music thanks to the NPR Tiny Desk Contest. I've been seeing her all over town ever since. It's been great to have her on my radar. She is terrific, and she coordinates, she collabs with the Lab Rats as well. So yeah, Year of the Rat is the name of the record from the Sacramento trio that sort of like blends funk and jazz and soul in such a satisfying way. And I started hearing about this band back in about February. I've been doing call-outs for voicemails. I've been playing people's voice messages on the show. And I happened to get two of them the same day about this band called the Lab Rats. And I'm looking around. And I thought, well, this is probably not a coincidence. But I started looking into it. And luckily, Jennifer Reason from KXPR invited them to the radio station before I could get my hands on any of their music. And they recorded what we're about to hear right here at Cap Radio.
It was such a treat because they were just across the hall as we were doing Insight. So that's one of the wonderful things about Cap Radio. And Year of the Rat, I was actually born the Year of the Rat.
So you want to learn keep coming back,
a little bit more about me. So Lab Rats is going to actually be performing live May 6th, the Starlet Room in Harlow's. So let's take a listen to Everybody Loves the Sunshine from Lab Rats. I love that. It's soothing. Mm-hmm.
It's smooth.
It's really a fantastic showcase of the talent of these three musicians. And when you have collaborators like Coco Leilani or Jakari Smith singing over top of that, it's just an excellent, excellent vibe. And, you know, as far as the recording that we just heard is concerned, we've got a lot more of that to come. You can hear some of this on Acid Jazz with Gary Vercelli. And really, the Writers Guild of America strike was a nice reminder for me that it takes a lot of people to bring me the things that I like. So this recording couldn't have happened without Andrew Nixon videoing it, Andrew Mills helping out with the sound, Jennifer Reason, as I mentioned before, Stephen Starbuck and David Bourne helping to mic this whole thing. Paul Conley is editing some fantastic video that I've got a chance to see just yesterday. We got some good things cooking with the Lab Rats, and I can't wait for everybody to see
it. Yep, recorded at Cap Radio Studios, which is awesome. We got a lot of talent here. Okay, Andrew, you're up next. The next band is Deerhoof. That's a very playful name. What do you like about Deerhoof?
It's a very playful name and very playful music, I think, is what draws me. In this band, I feel, is very esoteric, so my description should sort of be just as esoteric. And it feels like when you listen to Deerhoof, it's scratching an itch that you didn't know that you had. It's a bit confusing when you first tune in. You go to scratch your head a little bit because it's so out there and avant-garde. But then as you listen more, it sort of meshes and connects, and it's really poppy and like jovial and playful, like you were saying. And then at that point, you realize that the itch you were scratching of confusion is satisfying, and it's so great. I love listening to Deerhoof.
And they're going to be performing also at Harlow's Sunday, May 7th.
Yes.
So you can pretty much sleep there this weekend if you wanted to watch Lab Rats and Deerhoof.
Camp out there, get ready, get your music in.
I'm all for it. So we're going to take a listen to Scarcity is Manufactured. I like that title.
It was night by this day. It's every day at once. One for every visible star.
I am down with that percussion.
It's so much fun. They've got a lot of great rhythms going on and the really sharp and fun guitars. It's quite a treat to listen to. That was off of their slightly older album they released during the pandemic called Actually You Can in 2021. They just released a new album called Miracle Level this year, and I happened to play a track from it on this Saturday's Hey Listen.
You sure did. And what I like about Miracle Level on that level is the fact that I can always find like one or two tracks off of any given Deerhoof album. There's like four or five off of this one. So it feels, for whatever level of accessibility that might mean to you, I find that that it's more of that fits the show than previous records do.
Now's the time to hop on the bandwagon. Deerhoof bandwagon.
And after about 14, 15 records, that's a great time to do.
And they'll be performing live on Sunday in Sacramento. So the next artist, Andrew, is Haley Hendricks. And Haley will be performing at the Crest Theater Wednesday, May 10th, which is my birthday.
Oh, nice. Well, now you have plans.
Happy birthday. We planned it.
What do you love about Haley Hendricks?
I got the honor, you know, the great opportunity to see Haley Hendricks last year open for Lucy Dacus, and her set was so good. It was just her and an electric guitar just drenched in reverb in this really big hall. Me and the rest of the entire crowd were just like mesmerized, sort of like, she has a way in her music. It's somewhere between like indie and folk, and the music is written in a way, the songwriting, the lyrics are sort of witty and interesting, but also sort of nuanced and have a lot of like emotional honesty to them. And the music matches it. And so being there and part of that is super fun. In between songs, she's very witty and fun and has some nice banter with the crowd. And this particular show, she'll have a backing band, drums, piano, and trombone. So it should be very good.
Awesome. We're going to get a little taste. We're going to listen to The Bug Collector, and that is from the 2018 album, I Need to Start a Garden.
And there's a praying mantis prancing on your bathtub. my past life out to get you. And I digress. Cause I must make you the perfect evening. I try my best to put the priest inside a jam jar.
Our producer, Victor, said it gave him some Pacific Northwest feels, sipping coffee on a rainy day.
He's not wrong.
And he's wearing a Seattle shirt. So, you know, it is fitting for today. Okay, Nick, our last one is the band called Crumb, exploded on the scene back in 2017. What do you love about them?
I like the way they make me feel. The music is just an incredibly relaxed vibe. It's a Brooklyn combo that incorporates elements of jazz, chill waves, psychedelia. I can imagine a lot of, like, head nodding as opposed to straight up dancing at this show. It's coming to Thursday, May 11th to the Goldfields in Roseville. And they're also going to be backed up by an incredible trio called Automatic, which is just not to be missed. So, from their 2021 record Ice Melt, this is called Retreat.
I could slide around on that, you know? It's really smooth.
I was thinking if you wanted to flavor your road trip from Northern California up to the Pacific Northwest, Crumb would make an excellent addition to that bouillabaisse.
Okay, so I think next time around we're going to do a travel itinerary as well.
Oh, I like that.
Where would we travel with each song?
Travel pairings for each song. Got it.
As always, thanks, Nick and Andrew.
Thanks, Vicky.
And those are Cap Radio hosts Nick Bruner and Andrew Garcia sharing their quickly approaching concert selections for Insight's Concert Connect. We have all that information on our Insight page. And of course, you can always listen to Hey Listen. That is on Saturdays from 3 to 5 p.m. and again from 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about all of our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. If you want to join the conversation, shoot us an email, insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producers Nick Dobis and Victor Corral Martinez, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital producer is Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Our engineer is Chris Feltz. And our show music is produced by Adrian Gilmore. And I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend. We'll catch you right back here on Monday.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause. And rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.